measuring mode. If you put voltage across it, usually you blow the fuse. So that's not likely. Right now, from everything that I'm hearing, the highest probability is that it's a resistor used in the ohmmeter mode. You can confirm that by now choosing a number of resistors and trying to measure the resistors on the times one scale, the times 100 scale, the times 1,000 scale, and so on. One of those scales, you're going to find out it acts crazy. It doesn't zero correctly, or it doesn't measure resistance. That will be another confirmation as to the burned out resistor, what was it doing. The highest probability, he's burned out one of the resistors used in the ohm meter mode. And therefore, there's a ways of calculating exactly what that resistor's got to be. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, it's a senior voltamist, and it isn't a resistor burnt it out. I've had that problem, and it isn't the low ohm scale. Not the lowest. I think it's the times 10 scale. But what he can do is look at the value of the resistors from each one. He can get a rough idea. What I've always done is I put a very small potentiometer in there, a rheostat, one of the mini pots, and adjusted it until I got the exact reading of whatever I was measuring. And then I would either glue that or measure it and put the right resistor in there. I've gotten away with that quite a few times, and that works rather well. Yeah, you're right. On the current mode, you usually do blow a fuse. Voltage, that's rare because usually you wind up pinning the meter and wrecking the meter. But this is a senior voltamist, and this happens a lot of those. And too bad many people throw them out. It's a shame. It's a good instrument.
It sounds like you've made that mistake one or two times, John. Huh. I didn't think you did that kind of pilot error. Over to you, John.
Oh, yeah. That's why you must remember. You only do it when you're young, because you soon remember to return that value pot, your stroke knob, back to the highest value before you store the meter, so you don't make that mistake too many times. Yeah, I've done it a couple of times, as many people have. And not only on that, I've done it on a few other instruments, too. I'm pretty good at it.
I think the triplet and Simpson meter have a rotary dial where the straight-up position at 12 o'clock, I think, is the off position where the leads don't go anywhere. I think you're saying some of these meters, they don't have an off position. The best you can do is put them into the highest voltage range. John, go ahead.
Yeah, the senior voltamist, the knob on the left is your range control, and you always try to crank that up to like the 100K position when you're done. That's a nice meter. I've used it. It's very nice for alignment work, where digital meters really, you suffer using them. Even the ones with bar graph on it just don't work well. I use analog meters, and that meter happens to be excellent, and no matter how old it is, it's worth repairing. I'm sure you've seen them, Dick.
Yes, I think I have. Okay, do you have another question that we should consider? Over to you, John.
Yes, I do. I have a gentleman who's asking, can you transmit CW in a digital radio format? That'd be done. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, a Morse code transmitter, a so-called continuous wave transmitter, a CW transmitter, can, if you want to, put a brick on the key and you transmit literally continuously for the next 2 minutes or 2 hours. However, when you do that, all you're doing, the only information you're transmitting is that, yes, there is a transmitter, and yes, it's sending out a signal. It's the equivalent of standing in front of a classroom and whistling with your mouth a 1KC note continuously. You're letting the students know that you're there, you're alive, you're breathing, and your whistle is still working. Other than that, you're not conveying any information per se. In order to convey information, you must modulate that signal. The 1KC note coming out of your mouth could be considered a radio carrier at a very low frequency. Or you set up your 40-meter transmitter. It's transmitting at 7 megahertz. So you're transmitting a continuous tone at 7 megacycles, and you're letting the world know you're there and that you have the ability to transmit. Let me drop. But if you really want to transmit information. That's the whole reason for a transmitter in the first place. You want to transmit information. You want to transmit your name, your location, the signal strength, and you start modulating the signal some way. On-off keying, frequency shift keying, phase shift keying, FM modulation, tones that turn on and off with FM modulation. You have to modulate the signal somehow. Some of the methods of modulating are called digital. And it's a relative term. What's the difference between high-speed Morse code and digital communication? They start blurring a little bit. You and I could set up a machine to send high-speed Morse code at 150 words per minute. No human being could take it that fast. And I've got a fancy computer program on the other end on the receiver that takes 150 words a minute of Morse code and converts it back into letters and types them across the screen. I could call that digital communication. It is digital communication. It's just a particular format of on-off keying that happens to be the international Morse code. There's a zillion other formats I could be using, a million other protocols. So certain methods of modulation are called digital. Other kinds of modulation are called analog. The voice you're listening to me right now that's being FM modulated, it really is analog. Let me drop it. And in theory, you could be using a receiver that takes samples of my voice at 10,000 samples per second, per se, and measures the exact amount of voltage coming out of your FM discriminator, 10,000 times per second, represents that as a digital code, and sends all of those digital words, and now I'm transmitting digital information that started off as an analog FM audio coming out of this microphone, if you know what I mean. So the word digital is relative, but once you decide on what the method of modulation is, you now have the ability to transmit information. I think that's the first half, and I've forgotten the second half of your question. I know it's a compound question. Now give me the question again, John. I've laid some groundwork. Over to you, KQIIW.
Well, I have no reason. I don't understand why he's asking the question. Is he thinking about buying a digital radio like DMR? Now, when you have a DMR radio, is he asking, can you transmit CW on a DMR radio? Maybe that's the point of his question.
What you're really asking is, did the designer of the radio give you a knob or a button on the front panel that allows you to go from the digital mode to a CW mode? I could take any digital transmitter. In theory, I could modify the circuit so that when I press a particular button, it transmits a continuous carrier so that I could measure power output or whatever. Then I release that button and go back to transmitting digital information, which might be pulse code modulation, pulse frequency modulation, pulse duration modulation, pulse position modulation. There's a zillion protocols of digital-like transmission of transmitting pulses. Most digital transmission is pulse-like, but not all of them. So can a transmitter capable of digital, is it capable of transmitting CW? I think the answer is almost always absolutely yes, if and only if the manufacturer has given you that button and that knob on the front panel that allows you to go to that test mode. It is only a test mode, from my point of view, because transmitting pure CW is not transmitting information other than the fact that you're alive and you're present, and the transmitter is still working. KC2WGB, KQIIW.
KC2WGB. Okay, well, I guess he's thinking that if it can transmit voice, he should be able to transmit a 1KC tone or whatever that tone is going to be for the CW, and it should transmit. I think that's what he believes. So to change the radio over from standard digital to where it'll accept CW, I believe he's thinking it should accept the CW even in the digital mode.
Is it possible that he used the word CW meaning he wants to take a digital capable transmitter and now use it to transmit international Morse code?
Yes.
Okay. Can you take a digital transmitter and make it transmit something that's accepted as international Morse code? I think the answer has got to be yes. However, might have to give some other instructions to the guy on the other end so he knows what he's listening to. It might be a digital transmitter that's capable of transmitting pulses of tones, and now you're making the tones go on and off in a manner that's recognizable as international Morse code. There's a zillion interpretations of this rather ambiguous question, John. I think the answer is yes, but it depends. And how much modification of the circuitry are you willing to make, or did the manufacturer give you enough buttons and knobs that can do that? Is it within the laws of physics? Yes. You're now asking, can that brand name, does it have the right knob to do this function? It's sort of what you're asking. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I don't know. I think you should buy a digital handy-talkie and try it. You know, couple it into the microphone or something and see if he can transmit CW. Yeah, right. Very good. One more quick question. This one's an easy one. Let me let it drop.
If you've got a transmitter that operates in a digital mode, but it takes human voice, digitizes it, and transmits it, and then on the other end there's a digital-to-analog converter that converts it back into audio, then you have the ability of taking a Morse code practice oscillator, and you couple the code practice oscillator into the microphone, and now on that Morse code key, you transmit tones. If you know what I mean. So, you can use a digital transmitter with a code practice oscillator that has a microphone and transmit what the guy on the other end will hear as international Morse code. Maybe that's an answer. Over to you, John.
Yeah, that sounds like something. Yeah, okay. I think that's a good answer. That should work. So, I think he's on the right track. All right, now we'll go over to the simple one. Let me let it drop. I have a young amateur who's listening to telegraphy, old railroad style, and the enunciator, the clicker, and he's saying, what the hell do you listen to? It's clicking. Do you listen to the length of the click or the spaces between the clicks? How do you determine dots and dashes from one sound, Dick? Back to you, KC2WGB.
There's probably at least two answers to this one, John. The real Morse code sounder that they used to use gave a certain kind of click when the current flowed into the coil, the solenoid sucked into its armature got sucked in, and the bar got sucked down, and it made a click. Then, when the current stopped flowing, the bar moved up and hit the other spot, the stop, I'm going to call it clack. You're really hearing click-clack, click-clack. And so a skilled operator would hear the difference between the suck-in click and the clack of it being released. That's one approach. You also could, with practice, make a Morse code sounder where the click and the clack are almost identical in sound, but yet there is still a particular format of clicks that represent normal Morse code. The letter A, da, would really be click-clack, 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 click-clack. The dot is a click going down and coming back up. The dash is a click coming down, waiting a whole lot of time before coming back up. With practice, a skilled operator doesn't even need click and clack. He hears nothing but clicks, and he can still put it together. But the ideal way as a trainee would be listening to the clicks and the clacks. The click tells you when it got sucked in, the clack tells you when it got released, and if it was a short term between time between the two, you say that was a dot. It was a long time between the two, you say that was a dash. Eventually, you don't hear dots and dashes. You hear clicks and clacks, and the brain eventually starts converting that into letters. Very simple.
Repeater, timeout.
Very similar to what happens with Morse code reception as you exceed roughly 8 words a minute. You don't hear dots and dashes anymore. You don't hear dips and dahs anymore. You hear a group of sounds, and the brain says, that was an A. And the hand writes down an A. When that first starts happening, you'll say, who the hell did that? It's a matter of training, John, as I see it. There are people in the prison, in prisoners of war camps, which learned a particular method of communicating to each other by tapping on the wall. Well, they heard nothing but simple dots, continuous dots of a certain kind of timing between the dots. And they had a way of making up the whole alphabet, and it wasn't Morse code, but it could have been Morse code. Just so happens the first guys doing it happened not to be ham radio operators. So the popular method by which prisoners of war communicated with each other was really kinds of taps, and the taps had certain sequence of timing which represented each of the letters of the alphabet and each of the numbers. KC2WGB, K2RIW. No matter how you do it, it takes a lot of practice, John.
Yes, and the Vietnamese never figured out that code, which was graphically laid out in a square grid, and the first strike told you what row, and the second strike told you which letter in that row. Yeah, that was very clever. Beautiful. All right, that's it from the mailbag, Dick. That's it for this week. And thank you for those great responses. And let's go over to Paul and see what he's finding out about the space program. K2WGB.
When I first started with this sample, very short-range, very fast radar system, I was transmitting with two separate feed horns side by side, John, at 10 gigahertz. Two feed horns were about 3 feet apart, both aimed at a wall that was 10 or 20 feet in front of me. And I was transmitting a million pulses per second, and each pulse was a few nanoseconds long. And so that was so successful that what I did, I was transmitting, it was from a signal generator, only running milliwatts, and that was going into a sampling oscilloscope, a very fast oscilloscope. That was not rectifying the signal, it was displaying the signal directly. And that worked so extremely well that I started going to a slightly higher power later on in order to get more range out of it. But once you make the pulses brief enough and the rep rate high enough with the right kind of instrumentation, you'll get a really beautiful display. You're doing your sample at 150 yards. I recommend you do your first sample at 10 feet. Make it work at 10 feet, then start extending the range. Over to you, John. KC2WGB for a final on that. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, I was actually thinking of getting a couple of horns because I'm working at such a low frequency. I should actually get up at least above a gigahertz and play with it there. I could probably have better results. But as I set up this experiment, I will try to shorten that length because it would improve. I would have less loss, so I could probably improve the amount of signal. And I'd like to see if I don't know if I can get that 3-watt amplifier. I have to make sure it'll work at that frequency. But good information, Dick, and I will apply that to the test as soon as I can. Back to you, Dick.
There's a whole bunch of reasons why the amplifier is going to add extra complications, John. The noise figure of the amplifier, the noise power puts out in the off mode, and so on. The 0 dBm or plus 5 dBm out of the signal generator will be enough. If it's going into a feed horn on transmit, a feed horn on reception, and a distance to the wall of 10 feet, now you're sampling your oscilloscope, your high-speed oscilloscope will display that correctly, particularly if it is externally triggered from an external signal generator that's running very brief pulses at a rather high rep rate. You set that up with a wall 10 feet apart, you're going to get a beautiful display, and then step by step you can start stepping the range longer and finding out what happens until you get the full range that you want. Learn to crawl before you run, John. Now go ahead, K2RIW.
But what I'm going to set up, what I'm setting up to do is I'm eventually going to bounce it off the moon and get it right. And, of course, I'll be up, probably up near 10 gig when I try that. But I have to get a lot of equipment before I can do that. But good information, Dick. Back to you.
Okay, it sounds like this is a student experiment. You want to do moon bounce. There are roughly 1,000 guys on planet Earth as ham radio operators that have done moon bounce. And if you start subscribing to Al Katz's newsletter, the 432 and above EME News, has been publishing that for 30 solid years. You go to the right website. You go to the archives of that website. You can read every single past issue. Each issue has got about 8 pages to it as to what each guy in Europe and the United States and Australia and Japan, what they're really doing moon bounce-wise. Pictures of their antennas, pictures of the transmitter, the receiver, and so on. So when it comes to moon bouncing, for communicating Morse code, so to speak, or single sideband, let me drop. Lots of guys have done it. I have the impression from what you've told me up till now, you want to transmit pulses, and maybe what you want to do is specifically range the moon. You want to measure the number of miles to the moon, and you're going to measure those miles at apogee and perigee and look at the distance.
Exactly.
Okay, so you want to measure the ellipticity of the orbit of the moon by measuring the range at various times during the month. And that's a little bit unusual compared to the normal ham radio operation. However, what you're doing is called monostatic radar. When you listen to your own echoes, let me drop them. For a whole bunch of reasons, in general, your own echoes are stronger than the other guy's echoes to you, unless he happens to be a really big gun, you know, a guy running a 60-foot dish with a kilowatt into it. If you're both running the exact same amount of equipment and you try to communicate between you and your buddy in Australia, your own echoes will always be stronger than his signals if the equipment is identical on both sides. There's a bunch of reasons why I can explain that to you. So you've got that advantage. And you have a rough guess as to what kind of range resolution do you want. Do you want to measure range to the nearest 10 miles, so to speak, John? Over to you, KQRIW.
Dick, I would be happy with 100 miles. In the beginning, you know, I'll work on that as I go, but even 100 would be good.
By way of transmitting rapid pulses, in other words, you could transmit pulses fast enough. So if there's 10 pulses in the path between you and the moon, and 10 pulses in the path from the moon coming back, but by way of the timing of those pulses, now getting a very bright display, and you're getting an integrated image. You're laying those pulses on top of each other. There's a name for that, overlay. You're doing a temporal domain overlay of those pulses, and now you can integrate that, and you can get some very sharp resolution out of that if you do it correctly. This could turn into quite an experiment. However, if you chose, for instance, 432 megacycle ham band to do the moon bounce, let me drop the free space loss between Earth and moon and back is very well documented. It's extremely close to 263 decibels round trip loss. In other words, if you had a 0 dB gain antenna, you transmit some amount of power that's above threshold, that signal goes out to the moon, bounces off the moon, and comes back to your 0 dB gain antenna. The receiving antenna signal will be 263 decibels weaker. That's the round trip to the moon, back and forth on 432 megs, at the time of perigee. And it's got about 2 or 3 dB stronger than that at apogee. You've got to overcome 263 dB. You do that by putting up 400 square feet of transmitting antenna gain, 400 square feet of receiving antenna gain, and roughly a kilowatt of power, and less than 1 dB of noise figure on the receiver. That's if you want to do it with human hearing of Morse code. You now go to the weak signal Joe Taylor techniques, which give you 25 decibels of advantage. Now you can make that overall antenna gain and an area of transmit and area of receive you can crank back 25 decibels because the Joe Taylor technique gives you a digital signal processing advantage in the back end of that receiver system that gives you a 25 dB advantage. But one way or the other, you're overcoming 263 decibels of path loss. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
The dish I have is only a 36 inch, I believe. So maybe I'll have to go to 5KW.
guys have done moon bounce on 10 gigahertz handband with, I think, a 6 foot diameter dish and 100 watts. I think they've done moon bounce on 10 gigs, 6 foot diameter dish and 100 watts with a good low noise front end. And I think that was done with human hearing engineering. That wasn't done with Joe Taylor. That's sort of the absolute bottom of what has been done in the past. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Wow, 6 foot dish. Yeah, that's kind of big if I have anything like that available to me, but I'm working on it. But first I want to get the basics down and make sure I know what I'm doing before I step it up. But it's fun, Dick. A lot of interesting stuff going on.
Out of curiosity, John, roughly how many students of yours are involved in this particular project right now, or do you anticipate in the future?
Right now, I'm looking at two students that are interested. They like to build things and they like to test. They're not into the hobby as hams, but they're very science-minded and they're doing very well in school, showing interest in it, too. Whether they'll participate or not, I'm not sure. But I'm doing the preliminations before I get them involved.
What quite a few of the ham radio operators will say is that moon bounce separates the men from the boys. The guys who are capable of, first of all, there's roughly one ham radio operator for each 500 people in the general population. Rough rule of thumb, one ham per 500 in the general population. Of the guys that are capable of doing moon bounce, roughly one of them per 500 hams. So we're talking about one per quarter million in the general population. As you can tell, we're getting down to the creme de la creme here. You can see why they call it it separates the men from the boys. You've got roughly 720,000 ham radio operators in the United States. You go through the ratio of population versus hams, and again, it's roughly one per 500. Most of the developed nations are about the same. Canada, United States, Europe, Japan, Australia, very close to one per 500 are hams. But one per 500 hams are capable of moon bounce. So you've got roughly 1,000 people in the world that are capable of moon bounce. And so what you're seeking in general is not easy, John. It does separate the men from the boys. You've got a couple of advantages. By way of the past history of 30 solid years of this monthly journal put out by Dr. Alan Katz of what used to be called Trenton State Teachers College. Let me drop it. He's got 30 solid years of publishing that 432 and above EME news. And it's all archived and you can read it. So you can look at all of the kinds of antennas, all of the kinds of transmitters, all of the kinds of receivers, all the kinds of back-end processing and everything else. There's a hell of a lot of history, 30 years of history of doing moon bounce. You have the advantage of scanning that history and avoiding some of the minefield, if you know what I mean, some of the potholes. So you can choose what you think is the best antenna with reference to what you own and what you're willing to establish, and what's the best transmitter, what's the best receiver, the best noise figure, the best receiver processing, and so on. So there's a lot of history there you can look at, and so you don't have to reinvent all of this wheel. You're making a variation. Of all the guys that have done moon bounce, I think you can say that 99.9% of them have done it for worldwide communication reasons. I don't remember reading that anyone did it for ranging reasons, but they're worth doing. But it's not going to be easy. It's going to keep you pretty busy for quite a while. Let's see what Paul's got to say. WS2N. What's going on out there in space, Paul? WS2N in the Space Report. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Real quick, Dick, you know, I think they did it in 1946 originally when they discovered that distance. So with the advances of equipment improvement, it shouldn't be that difficult.
was 1946, Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. It was done in the 114 megacycle band with a phased array collinear antenna that was around 30 foot square. And I think they were putting pulses into it of around 10 megawatts, John, 1946. And you can read about that history. WS2N, K2IW, Grand Pole.
Good evening, Dick, John, everybody else. Yeah, Dick, a couple of things. First of all, I did send you an email. Last week's topic was what are the Chinese up to with their space stations. So I sent you three proposed ones. Well, one is up there, and then the other two are on their drawing board. One is supposed to go up next year. So I did send that. A couple of launches, not that much coming up as far as the United States is concerned. We do have a Cygnus launch coming up actually in December, which would be pretty good because that's by Orbital Science, ATK. And yeah, ATK now is involved with Orbital. You know, they've merged. So Orbital will be sending up the Cygnus spacecraft, but not on Antares. Antares was the one that blew up last October off of Wallops Island in Virginia. But now Cygnus, they've contracted with the Atlas V, Boeing Lockheed is helping them put the Cygnus up to the International Space Station to resupply it. That should be an interesting launch. It is an upgraded Cygnus, you know, it's an enhanced Cygnus. They sent one type up for the last, for the first two flights. But then this last one that went up was supposed to be an enhanced one. There's a difference in the spacecraft. It's bigger. On the Antares that launched it, it was 4,000, a little over 4,000 pounds of cargo that could go up. Now the enhanced version is 7,700 pounds, a little bit less for when Antares was launching it, but around 7,000 pounds. But now the Atlas is a bigger rocket, and they can do the 7,700 pounds. It's a longer spacecraft, they're both 13 feet in diameter, but the enhanced version is 33 feet long compared to the 24-foot ones that were going up. So this is good, you know, they send more supplies up to the space station. It also has a different, you'll notice that, well, if you follow the past missions, the solar arrays look different. They both put out 4,000, both 4 kilowatt solar panels. But the original ones were, you know, came out square type, you know, three squares on one side, three on the other. So you had, you know, they would deploy like that. The newer enhanced ones are round, they're fan shaped, and they open up like that. You'll eventually see that on the Orion system. You've seen it in the past on the Phoenix Mars lander, and you'll see it eventually on next year with the InSight mission that's going to go to Mars. So you know, even though they're both 4 kilowatt, these are much lighter, so gives them the advantage of sending up more cargo. I'd like to see that happen. And it's still scheduled for December. At one point they were going to make it a little earlier, but I think they're getting caught up with their supplies. They have another launch coming up. It was actually supposed to go up this morning, but it's now delayed until this Wednesday from Japan. Japan has the H2 cargo vehicle. They've already sent four of them up to the space station, and now this will be the fifth mission. They roughly fly these once a year. They do hold a lot more cargo than Progress does, but of course, Progress goes up 3 to 4 times a year. Japan sends the H2 up every once a year. So that should be going up, and we'll see that thing burst to the Harmony node. They'll reach out, you know, astronauts on board with the Canadian robot arm 2, and birth it to Harmony. They'll stay there for, you know, a couple of months, and eventually they'll use the robot arm to send it away with all the trash and everything on board the space station, and it'll burn up over the Pacific Ocean. It's not meant to return like the SpaceX Falcon that sends the Dragon up to the space station. So, just want to mention, you know, those two flights are the ones I'm pretty much interested in. They do have to restock the space station after having three failures. The one I mentioned was Cygnus in October, and then followed by the Progress mission in April of this year. And a couple months ago, you had the Falcon 9 blow up with the Dragon cargo vehicle on board. So they're getting caught up. They've sent up another Progress ship. They've now got their crew back up to six people. And eventually, actually coming up in the, I think the second or third week of September, they'll be launching a third spacecraft to the space station. So you'll have a crew of nine temporarily anyway for about 10 days. And why are they doing that? The reason for that is you have Scott Kelly on board and Konienko, the Russian, and they're both spending a year on board station. But the Soyuz spacecraft aren't designed to last a year. People could last a year, but the space station isn't. The Soyuz spacecraft isn't. So it's only got like a 240-day lifespan to it, so they're actually, you know, coming up in one spacecraft, and they're going to go down in another one. They're going to leave this one behind for a while, and eventually Scott Kelly and his partner will come back and launch at the end of that one-year mission, practice mission, to eventually get to Mars. Let me drop it. That's pretty much it, Dick. I don't want to hold it up. Not that many launches that are about ready to go. Looking forward to some of the robotic ones coming up in the future, like InSight to Mars. Of course, a couple of the ones that are ongoing. In 2016, we'll see Juno go into polar orbit around Jupiter. I'll be talking about that quite a bit next year. So pass it back to you for any questions. Light week for the SpaceNet report, and I did get Wesley's email. That's very controversial, dealing with, of course, whether or not we really went to the moon or not. Interesting reading, but of course, you know how I feel about that. Back to you there, K2RIWWS.
Yeah, thank you for that email you sent me about what the Chinese astronauts have been doing with their space station. And it's kind of amazing to me. You and I have heard way back in quite a few years ago, Jay Leno would periodically go into downtown Los Angeles, find a couple of people walking across the street, usually pretty girls, and start asking them questions about current events, among other things. And sometimes the answers they got were kind of peculiar. It's my guess, Paul, that if I chose 100 people downtown New York City, ask them questions about what the Chinese astronauts are doing and what their space station is like, I'm having trouble believing that more than one American citizen per 100 would know anything about the Chinese astronauts. Am I wrong on that? I mean, it appears to me that we have very little information in our general newspapers and news reports about what the Chinese astronauts are doing and what their space stations are like. WS2N, K2LIW, what do you think about that, Paul?
I remember going to work in the 90s, the early 90s. and just mentioning something about a space shuttle mission that was going up. People at work, one guy even told me, he said, oh, are they still flying a space shuttle? And this is, you know, maybe after 40 missions or something. So, the news of space exploration kind of dropped off drastically. It comes in waves now, you know, Curiosity landed, and that was big news. But it just goes away. The manned space program, of course, actually, I guess, tended to get boring over time. Like I said, another shuttle mission. They didn't realize how difficult it was to take out a RS-25, engine three of them from every shuttle and rebuild it and rework them. And put them in another shuttle. Kind of thing was going on for decades. So you're probably right, Dick. Let me drop it. I don't know about the number. I would say if you ask somebody about this, what's the Cygnus spacecraft I just mentioned, you know, a cargo craft, that's got to be one out of, if that's one out of 100, I'd be happy. But ask about the Chinese manned space program. Maybe one out of 100 would say, yeah, I know they sent somebody up one time. I think their first person, by the way, was 2009. But even a lot of people don't know, even India is working on a manned space program. By themselves. They plan on eventually putting three people in a craft and putting them into orbit. So, there's a lot of things going on. It just doesn't make the news. When we were kids, you remember 24 hours a day, you know, that's what we were getting with Gemini and, even the monkeys going up, Gemini and, after Mercury, and of course Apollo, Skylab, people followed that. Then it really dropped off, after Apollo 11. Back to you.
Yeah, it's only a relatively small percentage of the population keeps track of the American astronauts. But my impression, though, is that the amount of coverage in our newspapers and news reports of what the other countries are doing drops off even faster. We hear quite a bit about the American astronauts. We hear a little bit about the European Space Agency. But we hear nothing about them. We hear a little bit about Japan. We hear nothing about China. In fact, let me turn it around the other way, Paul. When is the last time in our general news reports, our nightly news reports, or newspapers, when is the last time you have seen any mention of Chinese astronauts doing anything? How long ago was it the last time you remember seeing anything in our general media about what the Chinese astronauts are doing? WS2N, KQLIW.
Well, when they sent the first one up in 2009, he went up by himself. That was pretty big news. And then the next flight, they sent two people up. And then the next flight after that, three people. The first flight was, I think, covered. That was, on TV and in the papers. But after that, I don't remember. I came across some of the stuff in the Times. I'm looking for these things. So that's different, once in a while, you'll read a magazine. For instance, they did have an article in the June Popular Science magazine, if you get Popular Science, page 51, I think it was, all about the Chinese Tiangong space station. So, that's planned, actually. So, you gotta look for it. It's in some magazines, but like you said, the general news media, I think it's just sports and weather. Murder and crime and fires back to there.
Dick, last time I remember is about a year ago they were talking about China going to the moon. I think it's a year. I haven't heard a thing.
That's right. Very good.
Give me a few words on that one, John. What did you hear about China going to the moon What impression did it give you? Are they a month away, a year away, or a decade away? Is it one person going to go? And do they give a reason they're going to go, just to say they can do it? Or they're going to try to collect some lunar soil and do some further research? Or are they going to mine valuables there? What was the purpose, and what impression did it give you, John? I don't remember that article. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, it wasn't an article. It was on TV. And from what I gathered and what I remember, they were going to go to the moon for the purpose of prospecting. And I believe they were going to try to land. It was either three or two astronauts, and they were going to inspect the moon to see if there was anything valuable that they could glean from the moon. Basically, that's what I remember. Paul probably knows a lot more about it than I do. If you remember, Paul, I believe you do. Maybe you could embellish it a little bit. Back to you, Dick.
To a naive person, to go to the moon to mine stuff, on paper, sounds good. Somebody may someday discover that they've got some gold, platinum, uranium, plutonium, something of value, diamonds, they're going to eventually discover is on the moon. Maybe in small quantities, maybe it requires a whole lot of refining, but they're going to find something there of value. And that's nice. But it's 240,000 miles away. Apollo program got us to the moon, but it took $31 billion in 1970 dollars to do that. I don't care what you mine. In modern day money, the Apollo program today would cost you close to $100 billion. What in the world can you mine on the moon to give you return on investment? Yes, because the learning curve has been passed, some of that money doesn't have to be duplicated. Maybe today to get to the moon and back with a colony, so to speak, maybe you can do it for $50 billion instead of $100 billion. But mining something there, no matter how valuable the stuff is, until you can get it back on Earth, it doesn't do you very much good from my point of view. So what's the real motive for doing that? But my impression, though, is that something about our politics, let me drop it.
You're right, Dick. Even if they find the Hope Diamond there or bigger, pales compared to the cost.
It's a little like playing a chess game. Your rook and your queen and your bishops and your knights are very valuable components if you can get them in the right place. But it takes a great big investment. You've got to make a number of moves to get them into the right place. So, I mean, you can try to assign a value of your bishop. And when the bishop is in its home square, it's got a certain value. When you get it two squares away from the other guy's king, it's got a hell of a lot more valuable. You've made an investment. Well, to get an astronaut and a spacecraft to the moon, you've got to make a big investment. And when you get there, are you going to find something valuable enough to give you return on investment? I'm very doubtful of that. The moon has got some value. If we can set up a real good radio telescope on the backside of the moon, it's got some real good value. Optical or radio or infrared or millimeter wave or whatever telescope on the backside of the moon. And to do space research, yes, it's got some real good value. And to study the soil and everything else to find out how did the moon get there. And it's part of our history. The best theory right now is that, let me drop it. The best theory right now is that some object almost as big as Mars collided with Earth in the very early days, blasted out a whole lot of material that eventually came together and became our moon. That there's a lot of correlation between what the moon is made out of and what we're made out of, what the Earth is made out of. So there's a lot of evidence that the Earth and the moon have a common origin. So it's unusual in that I think our moon, of all the hundreds of orbital objects around the planets that are in the solar system, only one of them doesn't have a name. Our moon. All the others have names. And so our moon is a really good size. I know it's bigger than Pluto. I'm not sure, but I think it's rather similar in size to Mercury. Isn't our moon and Mercury somewhat similar in size, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, you got a bigger moon, too. You got Ganymede going around Jupiter. That's supposed to be the biggest moon in the solar system. So that's even bigger than Mercury. Mercury. So you've got these big things out there to land on. Very interesting to do, and very costly. And to get back to John's comment about last year's moon trip, that was the Chang, little rover that they, actually it was a good, pretty good sized rover, but they set the rover up, a rover came out of the lander, and it was supposed to last, and they wanted it to last to a lunar night, which is 2 weeks, and they really didn't hear from it again. Did come back to life, though, at one point. They did get a signal from it. But their rover was successful. Had a telescope on there and took pictures of a galaxy and sent that back. So that was their first shot, and it worked out okay. And what John said is they're going to eventually try to send people to the moon. That's their long-term goal. They got a space station plan. They want to send people to the moon. And eventually bring back stuff. Trinium, I think it's one of them. They think they're going to bring the stuff back, and it's going to be good for hydrogen fuel fusion systems. We'll see about that. They've got to wait about 50 years, I think. What are we going to do with the moon when we get there? Well, you need to have a lot of countries put together to do something like that. The cost is going to be phenomenal. So I don't think you're going to see a big move to go to the moon anytime soon. I think maybe China will be the next people to land on the moon. Unless SpaceX gets their act together. We have the STS, a tremendous rocket that we're building with the Orion spacecraft. Orion is the leftover from the Constellation program. We were going to go back to the moon. We had the Antares. There was a landing vehicle that was going to land there. Not planned, but that was all canceled. The only thing that's left is the SLS, the newer rocket, bigger than the Apollo system, bigger than the Saturn V system. And the Orion spacecraft, and they talk about going to Mars. They need to do there has to be other equipment involved. You just can't get there and back.
Question for Paul.
Okay, John, you just can't get there and back with a big rocket and one spacecraft. You're going to need a space habitat system, maybe two modules similar to what's on the International Space Station for people who are living on the way to Mars and on the way back. Things aren't even, they're planned and on the drawing boards, but nobody's paying for them yet. So, I don't know. Right now, they thought of a mission. They call it the ARM, Asteroid Rendezvous, Asteroid Redirect. That's what they call Asteroid Redirect Mission. Grab an asteroid, put it around the moon, and then send people around the moon to bring back a couple of rocks from that. I don't know. The only one that's got his act together is Elon Musk. He tells everybody he wants to go to Mars. And he's got plans to do it, including something called the Mars Colony Transport. That's another long story. John had a question. I'm going to go on and on. Back to you, Dick.
Wow. And before I turn it over to John, I'm going to mention that this rover you talked about, can a lander onto the moon deploy a rover you think is going to walk around on the moon? A day on the Earth is roughly 24 hours long. A solar day is 24 hours long. A day on the moon is 27 days long. You and I call high noon from 11 o'clock in the morning until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 hours. High noon on the moon lasts for 54 hours. 27 times longer is a day, so 2 hours is going to be 54 hours. So high noon on the moon lasts for 54 hours. During the high noon time, the soil on the moon gets up to numbers like 170 or 180 degrees Fahrenheit. At nighttime, it gets down to numbers like 270 degrees Fahrenheit. Those are huge temperature extremes. To design electronics to survive that much heat and that much cold. And I might be wrong. I said 170 Fahrenheit. It might be 170 centigrade. It's an awful hot temperature that you get in the daytime and an awful cold temperature at night. So to make any kind of electronics to survive that is very difficult. Let me drop. To put an astronaut there to survive that temperature is out of the question. Look at all of those lunar pictures of an astronaut standing on the moon, and you look at the shadows, and you rapidly realize that they are there on the portion of the moon that's either in very early morning or very late afternoon when the temperature is somewhat reasonable. If you put them there early in the morning and you leave them there for another 2 days and it starts getting closer to high noon, you're gonna cook your astronauts. You put them there at late afternoon, you leave them there for a couple of days, you're gonna freeze the living daylights out of them at nighttime. So habitability, just because of temperature on the moon, is a really tough environment. So putting a colony on the moon rolls off the tongue real easily. We've got some huge engineering problems to solve to survive those extreme temperatures that happen on the moon, because the high noon is so damn long, it gets so darn hot, and there's no wind to cool you off, and the nighttime is so darn cold, and there's nothing to heat you up. There's no local water acting as a heat sink. There's no atmosphere evening out the temperatures. You get the real severity of what space can give you. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Paul, by the way, I saw a rocket test. I don't know if you mentioned that. I didn't hear it. They ran that engine for 9 minutes, and they were throttling it up pretty good. Is that for the SLS system, if you saw that test?
Yes, it is, John. They call that the RS-25, and they're going to go to another letter. I think it's E. I think they write D. But it's the RS-25. That is the same engine that was put on the space shuttles. There were three of them on the space shuttles. And that's how they launched off the launch pad. They didn't have three of them. They were hydrogen, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And they had, of course, the two solids that were attached to the whole space shuttle assembly. Now, what they've decided to do is some of the engines they haven't used. They were still in storage as backups, and they're taking these engines, and this is one of them. And they're getting, I think, 109% out of them, or maybe a little higher now. The reason they're going over 100% mark is because the space shuttle engines were all designed for reusability. They'd come back, they'd refurbish them after every launch, put them back to another space shuttle, and off it would go. Now, the SLS system is going to take four of these things. And instead of putting out 490,000 pounds of thrust each because of the higher percentage rating, I think they're up to 500 and I think it's roughly 520,000 pounds for each engine. And they're able to go over that limit because these are not reusable engines, so they could push these engines further. They don't have to worry about, you know, babying these engines. They're going to push them to the limit. Originally, the space shuttle, this SLS system was designed for five of these engines, but because of these upgrades they're doing to the engines, they've decided now on four engines. Some of the early animation you'll see, you know, if you look for an old animation, it'll show five engines, you know, this thing going up into the sky. Well, now it's four. And, of course, they're going to have the solid boosters attached to this SLS space launch system, similar to what we had on the shuttle, originally built by Morton Thiokol, but then that name is out now, so same people up in Utah. And instead of a four-segmented, four-piece